Hello, hello. This is Richard Bennett, and welcome to the High Tech Forum podcast. Today, we're going to continue the conversation that we had with Neil Davies about network quality of service, network quality of experience, and the report that he and his company, Predictable Network Solutions, did for the UK regulator Ofcom.
So let's talk about your Ofcom report. It's interesting because I think you're doing the work that you're doing that you did with Ofcom. They ask you to write a report about traffic management detection, which is to say the tools, primarily these are academic tools that have been, what, half a dozen or so, or maybe even a dozen such tools that have been developed by academics around the world that are trying to detect certain kinds of traffic management behavior on the part of internet service providers. And there are some good reasons to do that. Certainly, there's been a push around the world to enact regulations on internet service providers that actually prevent them from doing certain kinds of traffic management. And this is net neutrality, and I hope I won't have to use that word again. And obviously it doesn't make a lot of sense to enact a regulation that prohibits a certain practice if you don't have any way of detecting when that practice is going on.
Yeah. So, I think, first of all, we must think that this is what we're talking about here is not being sort of asked for or sanctioned by Ofcom. This is just me speaking, okay? But, you know, what happened was that the Ofcom went through its usual tendering process to get it has panels of experts that it sends tenders out to for this topic.
Mm-hmm, right.
So it came out with a tender for, as you say, traffic an analysis of the existing traffic management tools and their ability to do traffic differential traffic management detection. So they didn't use the word differential in the original call, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did was we sat down, did a literature search, worked out what was there, found out that, as you say, there was half a dozen key papers that described techniques by which differential traffic management could be detected. And I want to distinguish between traffic management, which goes on everywhere mm-hmm. all the time,
mm-hmm.
And differential traffic management, which is basically the trying to impose some form of differential outcome, given that it's occurring. Okay.
And so differential traffic management, for example, would be if a user is in a household connection, one user is running iPlayer and they're watching a television program, while another user is running Skype. And the differential part of it would be how the ISP manages capacity and quality across those two applications.
Yes, I mean, that would be a way of looking at it, in that if I was paying the bill and I was on a Skype call, if I was on a business Skype call from my house while the kids were watching, multiple video streams,
mm-hmm.
I would like it to be differentially treated
mm-hmm.
because I would like my voice call not to fail.
Right.
Okay. So differential traffic management by itself is not necessarily against the end user's interests, right? It could be very much for it.
Given the requirements of those applications and the insensitivity of video streaming to latency and jitter, it's perfectly sensible to do that.
Agreed. So the key point the point that we took off with this was the techniques that are out there were trying to look for effectively to measure that something was being delivered differentially.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And typically, and I think we have to sort of split this away from, as I said earlier, networks are about, they create, construct connectivity and performance. It is relatively clear to be able to detect differential connectivity management, i.e. blocking certain applications.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All right. So what we're talking about is not that form of differential treatment. We're talking about differential performance as opposed to differential connectivity. Okay.
And so this is the thing that policymakers like to call this prioritization, which isn't really accurate, but it's the term that they've kind of settled on for differential treatment.
Yes, and that the word priority always makes my flesh crawl, and we'll talk about perhaps that in a little bit.
Yeah, it's an implementation strategy to achieve something else that can be achieved in multiple ways.
Right, so absolutely. So Ofcom, now the interesting thing, I think we perhaps need to have a few seconds on what's possibly the different way in which, in general, the UK goes about regulation compared to other parts of the world. So in general, the UK tries to regulate on outcome and not regulate on operation. Right. So they basically say, so they give people the freedom of implementation, but they do ask them, and they do require them in the United Kingdom to, for example, confess is the wrong word, to basically make public their management policies.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they say, what was your intention? Okay, and basically all of the ISPs publish their traffic management policies. So the key question that Ofcom was looking for was not about abstract issues of fairness, but actually, was it possible to use the traffic management detection techniques to ensure that what was being declared was what was actually being done?
So it's there's a transparency and a sort of overriding transparency requirement on the ISPs, and that makes Ofcom's challenge then to ensure that the ISPs are doing what they say they're doing.
Yes, so it's about, I mean, the way in which, you know, Ofcom's sort of run under the Communications Act 2003 in the United Kingdom, and basically, you know, in the first couple of pages of that act, it basically sets out what Ofcom's remit is in general terms.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is it's basically to stand up for the little guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it basically says that small businesses, or the little guy and the ones that are inherently disadvantaged, like rural communities or, you know, the disabled of some sort or whatever, you know, and it's all in that process that Ofcom is, Ofcom's remit's all about making, letting the market do its stuff, except when it fails the small guy. Mm-hmm. And when it does, that, it has to basically show proportionality and various other, it has to justify why it did that in both economic and social terms. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that the greater good is there, but it doesn't have to make things, it doesn't have to take the most cost-effective economic path if it believes that it doesn't have it, that it's not necessary, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't have, for example, the ability to do voice-to-text systems because they're completely uneconomic to enforce otherwise. Okay, so I think what Ofcom was looking for, I mean, I'm not trying to put words in their mouth at all here, was a precursor to what did the tools allow them to regulate. Or what could they, if they were to use traffic management detection as a regulatory tool, would it be fit for their purposes?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's probably worth noting that Ofcom is, among national regulators, one of the more highly focused on network performance. I mean, Ofcom was, I think, the first national regulator to actually use the SAM-NOS tools.
Yep.
To determine the promise gap between the claims, performance claims in ISP advertisements, and what users actually experience.
Yeah. So measurement is de facto regulation. You see.
Mm-hmm.
So by measuring this stuff, it causes appropriate peer pressure to occur, I think is what the viewpoint. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and the in the unbundled model, I mean, you're really counting, you're giving the competitive ISPs have a lot of freedom in terms of what sort of service they deliver on the assumption that customers can switch carriers very easily, but they need to know if they're what they're actually getting versus what they perhaps what they expect to get.
Yeah, and I think that this yeah that so there's a whole bunch of you know and a lot of that at the moment that is all related to the peak speed, mm-hmm. right? That you mm-hmm. can get out of the system and how often you can get that mm-hmm. peak speed. But as we mentioned earlier, bandwidth and speed isn't actually necessarily what you need.
Well, and the SAMNOS test is actually very limited. I mean, the last podcast I had Henning Schulzrenner on here, who's a former FCC chief technologist, and that was one of the things that he actually did when he was chief technologist was look at what the test tools are actually measuring, and his assessment is that SAMNOS really doesn't tell you nearly what you need to know because it simply measures performance from the typical end user premise to a test server that's either at inside the ISP network or at the edge at the interconnection point of the ISP network to other networks. So it's users concerned about end-to-end performance, and SAMNOS just measures a very small portion of the end-to-end path because the actual full end-to-end path is extremely difficult to measure.
I would agree. And I think, to be fair to SAMNOS, this is a general, it's not just them. They've got the vacuum cleaner Hoover problem, mm-hmm. haven't they? They've mm-hmm. become synonymous with the measurement systems. Mm-hmm. But these things are measuring bulk downloads. And the way they go about measuring the bulk download deliberately removes all the delays characteristics mm-hmm. out of the system. So in order to maximize the throughput.
Right.
And so as apart from bulk downloads, they tell you how your they do tell you how good your system will be at bulk downloads.
Right. But it doesn't provide us with the insight I think that users of the internet want is a quality of experience prediction.
And correct.
And this is, I think, one of the issues that your report highlights really well is that the emphasis on quality of service doesn't really tell us what we need to know when we project from a single application world into a multiple application world. We actually, where different applications have different requirements, and the user experience when using video streaming is influenced by an entirely different set of factors than the user experience for real time.
Absolutely, and video streaming isn't even bulk download. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually an on-off bursty source,
yeah.
What filling up a playout buffer. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think so. So to back to where the report was. So what we did is we took the tools, and we placed them into the DeltaQ framework, and we analysed what they were actually measuring with respect to the loss and delay characteristics, and we looked at their fitness for purpose in various ways, and we looked at what they measured. We also looked at how would they help inform an isolation of where, if the issue were to be occurring, a performance issue were to be occurring, how would they, in a UK context, help you isolate where that issue was occurring, right? And notice I didn't say who was causing the problem because correlation does not imply causation, mm. right? So the first step is, you know, there's an issue occurring in X, why? Then you can ask, why is that occurring, okay? And it became very clear because of the way that, by analyzing. So one of the things we did was to construct a model of the structure of the UK's network and where the handover points were. We made clear where the handover points were and also were therefore able to say, look, there are management domain boundaries, there are administrative domain boundaries. If you can't isolate where the problem is to within a management stroke administration domain, there might be five or six of them involved just inside somebody going from a UK domestic premise to a server inside the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And several of those management points do not appear in the as routers in the routing path.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually below the level of the user level three networking.
So okay. We're talking about the handover points are typically Ethernet switches that are in exchanges and in aggregation points within particular networks. So,
well, actually, not necessarily. You see, not everything is parts of the UK network, for example, are tunneled networking protocols. Like LT, you would have the user internet connectivity is actually tunneled inside an LTTP connection. Mm-hmm. And the reasons for this are related to ownership of the IP addresses, for example. Mm-hmm. In a wholesale network, the IP address that I have is one of my ISP's IP address, not right. one of BT's. All right. And so I have there's a tunnel from my ISP, an LTTP tunnel all the way to my house, which is terminated in the which basically gets terminated in the BRAS or the MSAN before it's delivered to me. Okay.
So this is because the responsibility for delivering the traffic in that unbundled system is partially your ISPs and it's partially BTs.
Yes.
And so it's always difficult to distinguish, you know, the loss and delay that's introduced by BT from the loss and delay that's introduced by the ISP.
Well, actually, from an end-to-end perspective, you can't know where it is.
Yeah.
So it's yes, but it's not just the ISP and BT. That's mm-hmm. really clear here. It could actually be two different parts of BT, or for example, people like TalkTalk and Sky also run wholesale network services. So I could be, which also then use BT's networks for the fiber to the cabinet. So we are talking a complex and rich digital delivery chain inside the United Kingdom, right? All of which could, because, as we've said, you know, qualities of privation, it's the absence of quality attenuation, all of them could attenuate the quality to the point where the service doesn't work.
Well, and there are two different modes that ISPs have of using the BT network. There's some ISPs that, and some connections that connect at the port level, and the ISP actually manages the copper or fiber himself, but in most cases it's frame level.
I think what you need to, I think even it's actually, it's slightly I'd rephrase that in the sense that even where it's delivered over an Ethernet port, that could be PPPoE.
Mm-hmm.
So with the exception of one particular product that I know of, in which you actually give BT address ranges which they use, and it's a slightly different interface, which will bring us all into the issues of being able to insert video on demand and content delivery run by BT into the same stream, right, which is needed for that. Everybody else is basically using tunneled something to deliver it to. So in the case
tunneled is frame level access, effectively.
Yes, but it's being carried in IP.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean the point is we can talk a bit issues about, you know, how why this occurs and all the rest of it, and why, you know, the idea that the internet is global, everything is addressable, and all the rest of it is all hidden because you don't really want the end user being able to directly talk to pieces of critical network equipment inside the system.
Oh yeah, and so it's when you're tunneling, you have a virtual wire, but the virtual wire is composed of a number of logical wires that each have different behavior. So it the bottom line is that it makes accountability really difficult.
Absolutely, and that's the point.
And that's not even taking into consideration the fact that if you're having a bad experience when you're streaming video from a Netflix or an Amazon, the server could very easily be over capacity. And the end user has a difficult even in a simple system like the U.S. market, where ISPs are accountable for their behavior. What the end user perceives, this quality of experience, is he can't distinguish an overcapacity server from an overcapacity network.
Yeah. So the point is, even in the situation in the United States, in the US, right, where there's one ISP that's delivering it to you. Who says that the issue, the quality, where does the delta Q, the quality attenuation, accrue that's causing the problem? It could actually be in the home Wi-Fi network.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Right. So basically what you've got is this idea that until you can actually isolate where the attenuation is occurring, it becomes very difficult to regulate. Yes, because you don't want to, you can't sue ISP. You can't take them. You know. There's an interesting issue. As I said, one of the things that we did, one of the viewpoints we took here was we wanted to look at this system from the perspective of something that could stand up in court and could be used beyond on the balance of probabilities to demonstrate that someone had done something, some form of malfeasance that was defined by regulation, okay? And it became very clear that the set of tools that existed, the traffic management detection techniques, could not support that.
So at best, the traffic management tools that are in common use, they formulate a theory about what the expected behavior is. This is what I got from your report. They formulate a theory about the expected behavior, and then they look for that. And that theory is either confirmed or disproven.
Yes. So they seem to be taking the logical viewpoint that, and this I think is where, you know, we get into a bit of, you know, into philosophy and logic here. But it goes like this: the proof of the absence of differential traffic management, which is what they're measuring, is not proof that there is no differential traffic management.
Mm-hmm. The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence.
Absolutely. Right? And they you know, they do what they say on the tin, right? Let's be very clear here. As you know, they do actually do in general what they say on the tin to the levels of fidelity that they talk about, and you know, they have various costs in terms of, you know, how long they saturate links for, and how many ICMP router responses they time to live timeouts they use in routers. So in the scope of what they wrote, they work. But when you look at them, there are whole bunches of potential differential traffic management that they do not detect.
Mm-hmm. Well, there seems to be. I know some of these tools, like Glasnost, which comes from the Max Planck Institute in Germany, the creators of that tool were very interested in injecting themselves into the policy debates, and they seem to have written that tool specifically in order to promote a particular policy.
I don't think I can comment on that. We were not – one of the things we were very clear to try and avoid was this issue of – the author's intentions of what they were doing. We're looking at them purely as in the terms of what they were doing.
They set out to measure various things. And so there's always a question about whether the things that they measure are the most relevant pieces of information for regulators, or whether they're simply incidental.
Yes. And I think the point is, it can, something like Glasnost could prove that there was a differential treatment somewhere on the end-to-end path at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is whether that is that from a regulatory point of view, what you're looking for is something that covers all people, can help you isolate, can scale to the levels necessary, and then can act as something, if necessary, to trigger another set of problems, which would be an enforcement action. Mm-hmm. Okay, and those are costly, and you need to be reasonably certain, and you need to be, you know, it's like any process like that. You want to be certain that you can see it through to the conclusion.
Oh yeah,
All right.
Well, I mean, the reason I say that about Glasnost is that it was created at a time when the treatment of peer-to-peer file transfers was a very hot topic in the U.S.
Yes.
Because there was an enforcement action, a complaint that was brought to the FCC about Comcast allegedly interfering with peer-to-peer file transfers to for various nefarious reasons. But that peer-to-peer treatment was a big issue at that point, but it's become less critical as streaming has emerged as the predominant way to distribute video content. So we could have a system that guaranteed that peer-to-peer was treated, really, really well, but that wouldn't necessarily, in today's context, that's not very meaningful to the typical user of a broadband internet connection.
I would agree. I think that, I mean, I don't think that I do, I must admit, from a personal perspective, I find it very interesting when you sit down with or hear people on the, saying that the biggest users of their systems are called abusers. And the best user of your product is the one that you hate the most. I mean, there's something strange in the universe in which that is true. And then, this idea that the what you're seeing is the reaction of the people of the system trying to keep control of their networks, because actually they haven't constructed an economic model for selling them, and they can't allow these people to have unbounded access to the services.
Well, the economic model sort of depends on their being able to predict the usage and distribute the capacity in accordance with the usage and, get the upgrades out on time, but, not too
And
early.
get enough money from everybody who's using the system to pay for them.
Yeah, right.
And
So the thing that one of the things that I found really fascinating about your report was that one of the measurement systems, at least one, there may have been more than one, is a passive system. Like most of the test systems to measure network performance and the like are synthetic in that they put a particular load on the network and then observe how the network reacts to the load that they place on it. So there are measurements of the measurement system that provide us with, I think, somewhat limited insight into how the network operates when it's not being synthetically overloaded. So there the and about the only way to do that, I think, is to look at round trip times. So if you're in a position where you can observe round trip times at the TCP level between various points of transfer across the internet, then you get a pretty good idea of actually how the network is operating without when it's not artificially thrown out of balance.
Yes, I mean, I think. Okay, so let's split that sort of comment into two parts. First is, as you say, most of them were active. They were actively trying to cause the network, invoke the discrimination, right? If you take a passive approach, and basically, if you measure network, if you can observe packets, right? If you could have a sort of godlike powers to observe the net packets flowing through the system. If you measure the transit times inside the networks, no, if you can observe them on all the and timestamp everything everywhere, and I know this is practically impossible, but it's a good starting point for the thought process, and you construct the distributions of that, you can actually know everything you can know by observation, right? And the process, as you say, so I think that was Chuck Diff you were talking about there, is that you can then insert. This is sort of where we started to move towards the end because we looked at these. Let's just roll back slightly for the story. We looked at the techniques. We saw that the techniques came up short for what the remit was that Ofcom would need, and so we then said, well, look, what is there out there that might help? And there are potential approaches. With the right metrics, and I would say that bandwidth is not the right metric, but we hope that something like delta Q, something which has the appropriate mathematical properties of compositionality, and can actually be suitably subtracted from itself, could be used to observe performance in various places, and deduce what was happening across subpaths inside the network. This is a network tomography process that people have talked about. So what we saw was that although the pat the and having done that, you can having got an approach that is potentially passive, you don't have to do it for every packet.
Right, right. So
you could sub-sum.
You could intermix. You could say take some a fairly normal set of network interactions, encapsulate them within some sort of tunneling protocol that allowed forwarding nodes to timestamp before they passed it on, and then you could get a pretty good idea of what was going on in the network.
You probably don't even want to do that. You could there are ways in which you could just observe them and feed them back out of band. You don't want to do it in band because your problem is it's the sort of Heisenberg problem of packet working is that anything you do you want to perturb the system as little as possible.
Yeah, you want to so you could passively observe it by recording timestamps at switching points. And just sort of build up a database of what those things look like, and then maybe report them, when the network was loaded.
And I mean, with our, we did this for Ofcom, but it's a small moment of self publicity here. That's exactly what we do when we help.
And it's I'm not above letting you. You're the CEO of Predictable Network Solutions, right?
Yeah.
And you're a consultant, and you work with carriers and regulators to improve the quality of their networks. And that
is precisely the technique. I mean, one of the reasons we get involved in this stuff is that these are techniques that we've used for 10, 15 years, and that they help isolate these issues. Now, the key thing in a regulatory environment is if we're stepping slightly beyond the report here, is that there's no point in trying just to create a large, big stick to hit people with. Even the regulator wouldn't want to do that. But there are ways of constructing systems whereby you can know that something is not working properly and also collaboratively get the appropriate information so as to isolate where that is.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because at the heart of this... At the heart of the problem we have here is that actually the digital supply chain we see in our commercial work, and not just for regulators, people can't negotiate appropriate supply chain contracts with each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a big problem. I mean, if people don't know what kind of end-to-end quality is in the path, nobody knows if they're getting what they paid for.
Right, and so this issue of whether the consumer is getting what they're paid for is just the tip of the iceberg here.
Yeah, the ISP himself that forms a contract with a transit provider doesn't know if he's getting what he paid for.
And he doesn't know what, and often they don't know what to ask for, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they'll ask for a certain amount of cross-sectional capacity, whereas actually what they're really interested in is the delta Q from that point to other points in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually they can have a reasonable expectation that the Skype calls. Imagine they're an ISP working for. Imagine an ISP like there's several telephone MVNOs in this country that focus on particular ethnic groups. So so you can talk back to your motherland.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Yes.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now imagine you're an ISP that wants to do that. Okay, you want to differentiate yourself in your market. Currently, there's no way of really doing that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way of even constructing, walking up to a tier one carrier and saying, I'd like to have a contract which does this, please.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this issue of we talked earlier about fungibility and about bandwidth. This is an issue that everybody's dealing with, is that the big corporations can't themselves go and buy connectivity and performance services that they know will compose to construct a solution that will work end to end. So we have two problems here. One is how to measure it and find it out, which is a sort of top-down problem of I've built it, how do I understand how it's going to work?
Mm-hmm.
There's a bottom-up problem of how do I contract to my supply chain so as to construct something from the bottom up to the top.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the first an example that probably comes to mind is say you have a carrier, an MVNO, that wants to carry calls from say Bradford to Karachi, probably not a completely unrealistic scenario.
Yep.
And the way he would do that is most of his variability is probably going to take place in the link between London and
Mumbai or somewhere else.
Wherever the upstream is, because Karachi is not a major interconnection point. And at one point, I think their traffic was actually routing through China.
Yep.
Which made that whole YouTube mess, you know, so disastrous for the rest of the internet. But the international VoIP carriers, they typically buy multiple transit contracts from multiple providers, and then continually measure the delta Q of those multiple transit providers, and pick the one that's the least likely. That's the most lightly loaded at any particular time, but they're sort of dealing with things at a call level, so they have options that don't really exist for of general internet interactions.
Yeah. So what they're actually doing is they're typically using the idea, because this idea that, you know, loss and delay are related to the voice perceived quality is relatively well understood, mm-hmm. right? So they will use something like PESC to get a synthetic MOS score, mean opinion score, mm-hmm. and they will be measuring either the loss and delay or measuring issues directly trying to measure the MOS. Because they can make quality-based switching routing decisions, right? But you can't get quality-based routing at a packet level.
Yeah, and so this is something you can do because that application is so well understood and it has such distinct qualities. But to do it for the sort of quality of experience for the internet overall really is a question of the aggregate of the applications.
Yes, and I think what you're we're definitely way beyond the report here, but the mm-hmm. issue that we are now talking about is what is it you want? And what you want is a quantity of quality.
Mm-hmm.
And for various mathematical reasons, this stuff forms a partial order in the sense that it doesn't form a total ordering because you can have qualities that are better for some things than others. So for example, having loss in interactive video is really bad news.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. Interactive video, not video on demand.
Right,
whereas
right.
having loss in VoIP is not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Whereas having delay, for example, in timing protocols is bad, but loss is acceptable.
Right.
So there are, and as soon as you say that, it no longer forms a strict ordering. It forms a partial order. So there are ways, and this is stuff that we've talked to the ITU about, and various people in the States several years ago, actually, in safety critical circles, there are ways of taking what networks deliver, the statistical multiplexing, and distilling out better quality, distilling different qualities, which have actually different price character. They have different quality characteristics, but because of the mathematics, you can actually work out, and this is really fun, you can actually work out their cost difference.
Hmm.
And I don't mean, you know, in dollars and cents. You can actually work out the ratio of their costs in a strong mathematical economic way. So this also potentially gives ways of saying if regulators were to decide that they wanted to move to say, well, yeah, I'm going to allow a differential treatment in my services. I'm going to hold people's feet to the fire so that those services are delivered. And you mentioned a quality floor. You know, there is a floor, the worst case quality that you will deliver. Then you're going to have this issue about, you know, there's always going to be the issue of what is a fair price differential and what's an unfair price differential for various reasons, including competitive. Let's just take it from the competitive point of view. It's actually possible, for example, if you wanted the best, lowest loss, lowest delay service, and you want to do some form of really high-end gaming, right, which mm-hmm. you're willing to pay a bit more money for.
Mm-hmm.
When you compare that, shall we say, with some really bulk download system like a backup or something that's really non-time critical and can be time-shifted, you know, by hours.
Right, okay, right.
You can calculate what the difference in those in the pricing has to be. Well, you could calculate the cost, the differential in cost for traveling, capturing those two streams. This came out of the mathematics I did about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So we fundamentally, to try to simplify this without doing too much injustice to the complexity of your analysis, there's a certain quantity of quality that every network is designed to deliver, and we begin with this quantity, and then it's up to the ISP, probably in cooperation with the user, in terms of some degree of user preference being expressed to the ISP, to apportion that quantity across the different applications that the end user employs. And a happy customer at the end of the day is the one that has a sufficient quantity of quality to do all the different things that he wants to do, and B, has that quality apportioned across the set of applications he or she uses in the desirable way.
I think that's a nice way of characterizing it. We're actually working with a new ISP who's trying to use this stuff to the extent that you could have tailor-made cost-quality plans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if your focus in your life is you like gaming, we can basically, the system could deliver the best gaming experience at the cost of, because there's always a trade here,
mm-hmm.
but you can't, at the cost of making your Skype calls sometimes worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or basically, you know, if you're really into that point where the battle is really on in your first person shooter, maybe the video on demand will jitter and stop. Right, but interestingly, I see the ability to manage and deliver the differentiation and the supply chain is a way of getting the ISPs, because that obviously has a value to the end user at this point.
Oh, absolutely,
and could potentially therefore garner a price premium from them.
Right, well, and the utility of the network to the end user is entirely a function of the applications that that particular user wants to use.
Right, and enabling them to do that is what makes the network more valuable to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the marketplace that actually makes a lot of sense, where people are buying plans that are designed around a particular bundle of applications that are important to that end user. So they're paying for what they actually want. They're paying for what they need, and they're not paying for things that aren't related. So instead of buying plans based on what the peak download rate is, we should be buying plans that give us a certain amount of quality and then also provide us with the ability to apportion that quality the way that makes sense for our particular way of using the network. Because no two users are the same.
Exactly. And I think that what that gives you, and the interesting thing is, once you've got people making that self-determination, okay, this is about enforcing people to do not. You can actually, for example, you can then say, look, if you're willing to take this low economy class of traffic, which is really not really suitable for anything except long live backups, or shall we say Dropbox updates, or there's a whole bunch of non-real-time bulk activity going on there.
Oh, yeah, Microsoft patch updates.
Yep, I wasn't going to pick, Apple iOS 12 downloads, right?
Mm-hmm.
This actually brings us to a bit of work that we did with the Kent Public Service Network. We basically found that by allowing them to view the system in that way, they didn't have to upgrade as often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they could run their network into saturation. Because the key, okay, we've really gone way off the Ofcom report here, but this is still interesting. It's still interesting for the regulatory point of view, in the sense that the thing that we have found is that the key cost to ISPs of traffic is the fact that it pushes them to upgrade.
Right, right.
So the opportunity cost is they have to upgrade much, much earlier than they thought they had to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that sort of you were talking about, there is a related unwritten down debt curve that's that's related to, and the fact that they have to upgrade early means they can't write off. The write-off periods are not being right. So what you'd like to be able to do is push off upgrades, but you don't want to do that at the cost of the things that people value.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't want to do the next upgrade until you've paid for the previous one, but you also don't want to delay the upgrade so long that you lose customers.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I can see there's a regulatory problem there in that when the customer actually has no, they can't walk, right? Mm-hmm. Either because there are no, and this is the difference in the United Kingdom to say the US. You know, I can always get at least, although Openreach and Wholesale are well controlled, and actually, to be honest, their networks are extremely well run, mm-hmm. and never really, and they have the money and the resort to basically run them such that the quality is extremely good. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've measured them for 5-7 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to tell you that inside the United Kingdom, the typical upstream jitter related to the wholesale network or BT's wholesale network is less than 5 milliseconds.
Wow. That's amazing.
Right? 365 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
The downstream is less than 15.
That's great.
So basically, the inherent quality of the wholesale network in the United Kingdom is extremely high.
Right? And this is because of, BT's really good at network engineering.
We had a small hand in some of the planning roles as well. But the way in which they formed their, it turns out the way they formed their planning rules, they basically formed them in terms of a quality floor.
Okay. And right? And you probably helped them to conceptualize. Well,
actually, they didn't realize they formed it in a different way. They asked themselves a different question, but it turns out that what they formed, which is the thing that we actually mentioned in the report towards the end, is that what you need, the Ofcom report, is you need a guaranteed floor of quality.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically said, we will deliver something at, and by doing the way they, because they talked about TCP throughput 90% of the time in the busy hour and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. It turns out that achieving a particular TCP throughput is nothing to do with the capacity of the network. It's actually to do with the loss and delay characteristics.
Yeah, yeah. So like, they were really measuring delta Q.
They were really actually trying to set themselves a delta Q flow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And what that has meant is that the inherent planning rules, they don't always work, right? You know, mm-hmm. there are, as I speak, there are probably, half a dozen places where they haven't upgraded quite early enough because of, or they've failed, there are various, and there are ISPs in the United Kingdom that measure this and get onto them and hold their feet to the fire. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So they have the advantage of having a very sophisticated set of customers because they're in the wholesale business. So they're not dealing with unsophisticated end users. They're dealing with other networks.
And some of those are very sophisticated and they basically fight for their customers' rights. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that gives me choice as an end consumer in the United Kingdom, right? Mm-hmm. I can, because my last mile and my middle mile are purchasable at a price mm-hmm. from somebody whose network really works, I can choose which retail ISP mm-hmm. I use. Okay.
Think in the long term, the end user choice that we have in the US right now is fairly limited, but in the long term, I think the wireless is going to become an option that's realistic for a lot of people. Not necessarily fully mobile wireless, but maybe some sort of a reduced capability LTE, 5G LTE, LTE advanced system. I think will actually, a lot of people in other countries that have extremely high capacity networks like Japan and Korea, there's a lot of cord cutting going on, and young people in particular are just going wireless, just all in on wireless.
Yeah, I think that's probably, at this point, I can say that's definitely another conversation we should have at another time. Mm-hmm. this is way off the report, but that we I think the there are, and actually we do discuss some of this issue of the difference between the ability to manage this stuff in wired. It's actually not to do with the wireless or the wiredness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's actually to do with how the multiplexing and sharing occurs. Mm.
Well, and it's, yeah, there is a sort of a gross capacity that the reason that, that wireless is not a realistic option for most people today is capacity constraints. And some of those are spectrum related. Some of them have to do with the siting of towers and cell sizes and, you know, that sort of thing. So it's not a practical option today. It's something that, you know, that may happen in the future. And,
so with highly dense radio networks, because that's the only way it's going to happen, is with mm-hmm. densification mm-hmm. and suitable contention domain management. So this is, you know, a lot of it will be point to point and actually switched. Mm-hmm. That's in some way, as opposed to distributed contention domains. Mm-hmm. And what I mean mm-hmm. by a distributed contention domain is something like the upstream of a 3GPP or no, i.e. 2G, 3G, 4G, 5G.
Yeah. I mean, we have to get into the millimeter wave and the effectively the technologies that give each individual a point-to-point connection and shield him from contention with other users.
But it's all about the isolation and what you can get when you ask absolutely. For it. Yeah. And we've rather wandered off the point, but yes. So let's just finish up with this with what we said mm-hmm. with the off. So yes, there's a rich environment in the United Kingdom. The techniques that were there, although doing what they say or they do is on the tin, couldn't be turned around because the point is what you need is something that goes from the intentions of what people want, the intention to what they actually wrote down, the denotation, what they wrote down, down to how they operate. And the outcome of that operation is you want to be, is what they, is basically what the regulator's interested in. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the traffic management techniques is what people have used them for, actually, not the techniques themselves, but how they have been used by people, pundits in the debate system, is to take the measurement of differential, to go the opposite way up. I saw differential treatment, therefore they must have written it into the system and therefore they intended bad things to happen.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's just wrong in the terms of a logical reasoning system. It's wrong.
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, if I'm slowing down the video streaming because I want the Skype to look better, and my critics only look at the slowing down of the video streaming and they don't look at the Skype performance, then I'm not getting fairly assessed.
Whether that was an intentional malfeasance or not is even yet another question, okay, as well. So I think what we basically came down to was this issue that, yes, you need to regulate, but actually what you need to raise is you, if you regulate something like a quality floor, which is basically a quantity of at a particular quality,
mm-hmm.
That will mean that, and imagine you just picked one, right, for the moment, mm-hmm. and you applied it to everybody, that means that everybody could rely on it. The current problem I see with the current systems is that there is no quality floor in the way in which products are currently sold. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee for fitness for any purpose in any ISP contract these days, or retail ISP contract. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yet as a society, we are looking to depend on it.
So yeah. we need to completely change the way we think about what we're buying when we make a contract with an ISP. The regulators need to think about what it is that it's actually a really basic question about what's the service. How
yes.
do you define the service?
And they used to be able to define. They used to define telephone that was basically audible, right? So mm-hmm. there was a fit for purpose system there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't define you have to pull apart what the network delivers and what the application delivers, because you can't hold the network responsible for the failure of the applications.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? So the nice thing about the Delta Q approach is you can do that. Right? So you could, for example, as a sort of generic political level, decide that everyone should have the ability to be able to do some form of telemedicine from their house.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Let's pick a nice social thing, right? And this requires X upstream and Y downstream at a certain quality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Having done a bit of, you know, worked out what it meant and all the rest of it, you come up with those numbers. So you don't go to the ISPs and say, you must make telemedicine work, because they'll just say, hey, I can't do that. What you do say is, you must be able to deliver this quantity of quality.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that it will be able to deliver telemedicine on demand, right? And then you have the basis on which, because this is where the social and the regulatory side start to break it into each other. There's a lot, I know of lots of projects which have failed to deploy on real world networks because actually they're not trustworthy enough. So, for example, issues of, shall we say, remote diabetes management, okay,
mm-hmm.
Where basically you need the ability to have with a high degree of certainty, the appropriate interactive quality, the ability to run the cameras, to take the appropriate photographs, to get the measurements, etc., so that you can make to a high degree of fidelity, a good clinical judgment remotely.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So basically,
yeah, I mean, as we're moving, this is really important as we're moving into probably the next phase of the internet, which is the Internet of Things. We can predict that there's going to be an explosion in applications. There's going to be, and these applications have different characteristics. I mean, there are things where you absolutely need to have very tight real-time response when you're running a driverless car.
Yep.
And there are things that are, you know, people are still going to surf the web and all that, and then people are still going to download patch updates. So we're going to have, and they're still going to use Skype, so we're going to have this variety of applications that have very specific needs that can, in principle, be harmonized on a generic network, but they can only be harmonized through active management of the network and recognition of what the application's requirements are.
Yep. And if you don't do that, if you say everything has to be treated the same, then you have, and you try to legislate that in some mm-hmm. way, regulate for that, you are basically going to say that all, you're going to say all of the traffic must be carried with the transport characteristics of the most demanding application.
Yeah, and the economics completely blow up when you do that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think networking, the analogy we use when talking to people is that actually they're not in, networking is the wrong term for this process. They're no longer in telecommunications. They're in data logistics.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. What they really want to be is the FedEx of information transfer.
Yeah, you've got pairs of applications that have specific delivery needs, and the applications need to make those known to the transport provider so the transport provider can allocate the resources and provide that actual service.
Yeah. And there are ways to do this in a cost-effective way.
Well, this is one of the Martin Geddes, who's one of your colleagues at Predictive Network Solutions. This is an issue that he, I know, has worked on for many, many years about the fact that the traditional telecom providers need to understand they're not in the telecom business anymore. They're actually in a data logistics business.
Yeah. Absolutely, they and that's a shock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know, ever since about the late 70s, early 80s, telecoms networks, in the nicest possible way, have become irrelevant
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
actually they've ceased to connect human ears to human mouths,
mm-hmm.
right? They actually started connecting processes to other processes.
Right, right.
It has become a complete distributed computing problem.
Yeah, it's all, I mean, what they're doing is actually facilitating inter-process communications.
Absolutely. As you've talked, yes.
Yeah,
John
computer guys, we all understand that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But the general public, they're like, what? What did you just say?
it's actually, as a slight aside, the BBC is put on its iPlayer recently. We have a science program that's run for many tens of years in the UK called Horizon.
Right. Oh yeah, it's a great show. Yeah.
Yes, and they've picked out one from each year to be the exemplar of that year. Mm-hmm. And the exemplar from the year 1978 is all about the birth of the microprocessor and how it's going mm-hmm. to affect our lives today. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about how that now the chips are down, it's called, right?
Yeah.
And with a discussion afterwards, a bit like what we're doing now, discussing the state of the world in the future or something.
Mm-hmm.
And what was fascinating is the questions are the same. Right, the comments are the same.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And what they failed to see, and actually the attitudes are the same. And it's the interesting attitude that I found, having watched this recently and talked it through with my daughter for various reasons, who was, by the way, in their 30s, or early 30s, mm-hmm. but say very early 30s, or I'll get into real trouble, is what's missing is they didn't see the distributed computing in that. They saw it as machinery.
Right? Yeah.
We've left the world of machinery and physical objects. Mm-hmm. We're slowly leaving that world now because we're getting into what really matters is the spatial and temporal distribution of data and information and processing of it.
Yeah, I don't want to toot my own horn or anything, but the Scientific American had an issue in 1977, I think it was, called the Microprocessor Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And reading that article actually had a lot to do with the decision that I made to actually get into the computer business. And I remember I went on a job interview at Texas Instruments in 77, and they were building a desktop computer, which they called an intelligent terminal.
Mm-hmm.
It had a 16-bit microprocessor, a multitasking operating system, and a high-level programming language sat on your desk. And the first thing that came to my mind is, gee, what happens when everybody has one of these on their desk and they're all connected around the whole world?
Yep, and we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, but we've made a few steps, though.
We've made a few steps. We really have got, you know, we really haven't quite got the seamless, you know, I couldn't go and wander into my neighbor's house and use theirs for my purposes.
But we're still dealing with a number of the same technical issues that we were dealing with back then. That really is true.
And
we've come up with various expedient solutions along the way that enable us to, you know, to get a network going that did ostensibly connect everybody at some level. And now it's a question of making that network perform the way we want it to perform, which is really not that different from what happens when you're developing networking software, you know, in a lab. I mean, you do 10% of your work to get the first packet to be delivered, and you're very excited. Hey, it worked. You know, I sent it and I received it. And then 10 minutes later, you kind of look at how much time it took and you go, oh, shucks.
So that's 10 packets of demo I can send, yes.
Yeah, and then you spend the other 90% of your time you spend on making it run faster.
And, so that's one resource consumption, right?
Mm-hmm.
The resource consumption that we have dodged two or three times, we've hidden in technology changes, mm-hmm. is how we perform the coordination, the signaling, and the matching of supply and demand.
Yeah. That, I mean, and the whole system, I mean, like John Day says, it was all carried along by the advent of fiber optics. And so there are some really severe design shortcomings in the internet architecture that haven't really mattered, because with the capacity of fiber optics doubling every 8 months and the prices falling even faster than that for the last, you know, 20 years, efficiency hasn't really been that much of an issue. But now that we're in this sort of mixed media world where a lot of what we do is wireless and some of it is still on copper wire and
the optical fibers, you know, I was at a Royal Society meeting five or six months ago, and basically the end of that optical fiber is in sight, not in terms of peak capacity, right? You can still get it, but actually in the terms of picojoules per bit transmitted, mm-hmm. you know, the efficiencies, the energy efficiencies and the costs, mm-hmm. that they're not dropping as fast as we'd like them to. So we're reaching, you know, one of my other favorite cases, there's no such thing as a J curve. There's just an S curve you haven't found the top of yet, mm-hmm. right? we're basically finding that everything's limited. And we have to, you know, and eventually we have to, you hit those limits and you've got to live with it inside them, right?
So we're not going toward a world of abundance?
I think that the point is you can't have switching abundance,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in the sense that you can't build a network that gets fatter in all directions.
Oh, right. You can make one that gets fatter in one dimension, but that simply shifts.
But only for half of its journey.
Yeah.
But only for half of its journey, because then it's got to get thinner to get to the other edge, right?
Yeah.
And that basically means that contention is here, right? And contention affects delta Q is here forever.
Well, that's no fun.
Well, it keeps me happy. I mean,
well, it means that we have these fun mathematical problems that we're probably never going to have. There's never going to be an ultimate solution. I mean, and that's fine. I mean, that's the way technology works, right? You solve one problem and it makes another problem crop up somewhere else. And so you go solve that one. And that, you know, that's the kind of thing that keeps technologists happy.
Yeah. So let's just rephrase that. I think that it is impossible to build a system that is continuously optimal, right?
Yeah, and
at any point in time. But there's no—I don't think there is a problem in building a system that is stable and works over that meets society's needs. Okay,
and is improvable,
and is improvable, and economically sustainable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right, because what I'm saying is it's impossible, even with infinite amounts of money and effort. It's super abundance that never stops everywhere. It's not possible.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
But there are going to. I can see that we could construct systems out of the heterogeneous set of transmission media we were discussing earlier that could deliver, societal needs into the future.
Well, and they all they have to do is support a diverse and ever-increasing set of applications. I mean...
Yep, and basically, the good news is that basically human beings can only be doing one thing at a time, and everything else... I've sat down and watched people talk about, you know, the growth of video on demand, right? Mm-hmm. And then they talk about... And I said, well, when are we going to grow our third eyeball so mm-hmm. that we mm-hmm. can watch this stuff? And by the way, there is a problem with your prediction in the sense that you're talking about so many hours of the human race watching it that actually there won't be a next generation because no one will have a chance to procreate. Right? So the point is there are limits to all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start, and there was an interesting report last year from the Broadband Stakeholders Group in the United Kingdom, which basically started to point out where those limits might lie for certain types of technologies, right?
Yeah, really. I mean, these capacity limits, one of the key sets of factors is the bandwidth requirements of the human sense organs.
Yep. I mean, you know, by the time, I am not in the believer in oxygen-free Ethernet cables improve video, improve sound sources, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But so there comes a point whereby, you know, my wife already says she can't see the difference between HD and SD television.
Mm-hmm.
What market is there for people for 4K?
I know people who have seen it who it's breathtaking and it has made real believers out of people who were skeptical about the value of HD. Because HD, I mean, certainly when you're using HD to watch a news program and all it really shows you is the facial hair and the zits on the presenters. It's not really much benefit in that. But
I can see not necessarily the HD-ness, but the lack of visual artifacts and in sport, for example, fast moving games.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yes, I can see that there might be general markets for it, but there again, or specific markets for it. So I'm not saying I'm not trying to. What I'm saying is that they all. But you know, given you've got 4K, will 16K be what we be next? No, there are limits to some of these things. Having said this, no doubt in 1,000 years' time, there'll be people laughing because basically
Oh, yeah. I
they've
mean,
never found other things that they do anyway. There's always going to be a demand for more. It's whether that demand is, you know, whether everyone, the more for everything and everybody and everywhere under all circumstances is the thing that I think is unsustainable.
Well, I mean, maybe if we had this, if we had this conversation in 10 years, instead of a an audio Skype connection, you know, we might be it might be a holographic conference, you know.
Well, and it could be a holographic conference. I look forward to it.
Well, I just look forward to
I'll have
being
to put better
alive in
socks
10 years, but
on. I'll have to put better socks on. I mentioned.
that's great. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, and I really appreciate your giving the time to High Tech Forum and to me to have this conversation. I know there's been a lot of interest in the U.S. in the report that you did for Ofcom, and the I wrote a blog post on High Tech Forum about it that's titled "Understanding Statistical Packet Multiplexing," which may not be the most clickbaity title, you know, anybody ever did. Maybe I should have said why your internet connection sucks, but or, but
Well,
I do appreciate this an awful lot, and thanks for your insight.
it's been a pleasure talking to you.
And I hope we can do a follow-up on this again. I think the everybody keeps John Day keeps coming up in all these conversations, so I'm going to have to put him in the queue for a pretty soon podcast as well.
Well, John and myself know we know each other well, and I think there are definitely because you know. There are definitely interesting things afoot where maybe we can actually construct an internet as opposed to a catenet that we have at the moment. You know, maybe in 10 years' time we will have that hologram, but I think it won't be necessarily happening over IP. How's that for
Probably,
a closer?
yeah, that's great. Okay, folks, so if you enjoyed this podcast, you know, there are more on the hightechforum.org website. We're also on iTunes, and so you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can read the summary blog posts on High Tech Forum and leave comments there. If you really liked it, you know, give us a thumbs up or a review on iTunes, and you know, we'll keep the show rolling. And once again, our guest today was Neil Davies, the founder and CTO of Predictable Network Solutions in the UK, who's recently written a report for Ofcom, the UK regulator, on traffic management detection systems. So thank you, Neil, and have a good day.
Thank you very much.